Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Reuven Lerner, the amazing trainer, author, and consultant, and we're going to talk about technical training and how to get started there. This episode is brought to you by FreshBooks, cloud accounting software for freelancers and small business owners. If you work for yourself, you know that the world was not built for the self-employed. Many institutions are simply not keeping up with the pace of change, like banks, retirement savings, employment insurance, and accounting services. FreshBooks is among the innovators who have stepped up to provide a new accounting solution in this rapidly changing world. FreshBooks is offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial to our listeners. To claim it, just go to freshbooks.com/UIbreakfast and enter UI Breakfast in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Hey, Reuven.
Hey, Jane. Great to be here.
Thank you so much for making the time.
My pleasure.
So we're going to start with a short questionnaire. And question number one is a hard guess. What do you do for a living?
So nowadays, I would say about 90-95% of my time is spent doing training in companies, mostly Python, a little bit of Git, regular expressions, and data science, machine learning. And that's like most of what I do. I also do a little bit of development, a little bit of consulting, and I have a growing number of products. But really, like, training is like what I do just about every day.
Right. And just to make it clear, I brought you on board because technical training is applicable not only in development, but also in UI, UX, and design as well. So you can teach all kinds of disciplines, right?
Yes. In fact, it's like crucial. I mean, I'm not a designer, but even I know that there's a lot of really bad design out there. And a lot of companies are are desperate to find out how can they improve their design so they can have more satisfied clients and thus make more money. So it's definitely something that companies do training in and would be interested in doing.
So question number two is, how did you get there?
So basically, I started consulting in 1995 when I first moved to Israel. And most of that consulting was programming. At that point, it was Perl and doing some Linux and web stuff. And little by little, some of my clients asked me to teach them to do what I was doing. So I did one course here and there, and then sort of picked up to doing it on a more regular basis. But the real sea change was probably, I guess, close to 10 years ago. I did a PhD a few years ago, and when we came back from doing the coursework in America, I happened to bump into a friend who said, oh, if you're not looking to sell your own courses now, if you're trying to finish up your dissertation, why don't you go through a training company? So I did that. So for a few years, I was working through a training company, and then things really picked up. Basically, they would schedule me for a course, and then two courses, then three, and then four. And it got to the point where we were scheduling 3-4 months in advance to fill up my calendar. And that's when I started to listen to the advice that I give to other people, as well as that I hear from many people, which is you should specialize in something. And I said, well, I really love doing the training, and there's high demand for it, and I could make a lot more money if I didn't go through the training company. So I sort of made a strategic decision, I guess it was about 3 years ago now, that I would mostly do training and I would do it on my own rather than through a training company. And it was truly one of the best decisions I ever made for my career.
Wonderful. Sounds great. What does your typical day look like? Or maybe a week or a month, because you're very, very sporadically traveling around the world all the time.
Yeah, so I once said to my children, I have three kids, and I said to them, you know, most grown-ups go to the same place for work every day and work with the same people. And they were like, no way, can't be. So nowadays, I would say, I mean, I probably travel abroad from Israel once every 2 months or so, either going to Europe or to China. The rest of the time, I'm typically training in Israel. But most Israeli companies don't like doing courses multiple days in a row. So if I have a typical work week of 5 days, and if I'm training all five, which I'm trying to stop because it's kind of tiring and exhausting, but like if I'm teaching 5 days, I will likely be in 2 or 3 different cities, twice in each of 2 cities, something like that. I'm also increasingly teaching online using WebEx for some of my clients to get to people in Europe and America. And then I'm working from home. So it's really quite a mix. And if it weren't for my calendar, I would be completely lost as to know like which train to take in which direction.
Wow, that's a big mix.
Yeah.
What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
So there are a few things I really love about it. One is that I get to meet on a regular basis with really smart, interesting people who just don't know the specific topics that I'm teaching, but are really curious about them and want to learn and are excited about learning. So, you know, they come enthusiastic. It's like, once again, my children ask me at some point, so how often do you need to yell at your students to get them quiet? Because that's what our teachers do in school all the time. And I'm thinking, oh my God, like that's a different set of problems. But no, the people in my courses typically are there because they want to learn. They know it's going to improve them personally and knows that it's going to make them more valuable employees at their company. And so get them better pay, better status, and better recognition. But another part of it is, you know, a lot of people think, well, if you're doing training, they're not really getting to do the cool development stuff that all programmers want to do. But I find that it forces me to research all sorts of topics that I was always curious about. And if I'm going to teach it, I better know it really well. And if people ask me questions, I have to know it even better to answer them. So I see it as personally satisfying also in that I get to learn all these topics that I didn't really know so well before. And over time, it makes me a better developer and a more sort of more sophisticated consumer of technology.
Right. That's a great case. What about the least part? What do you like the least?
Let's see. So sometimes you just have crazy clients. I know that will come as a huge surprise to you and other people. But sometimes they're just kind of crazy in terms of what they ask for. But most, I would say the biggest problem is just the mismatched expectations. For example, I teach an advanced Python course. And so when you go to a company and say you teach an advanced course, everyone thinks that they're advanced. You know, the person who took the intro course 5 years ago and hasn't touched it since, and the person who's just really smart, and then the person who really uses it every day. And trying to combine all those and trying to square that circle can be very frustrating and really difficult to do, if not impossible.
So is it the diversity of the audience or mismatched expectations or both?
Both. So, I mean, I taught the advanced course, I guess it was about a month or two ago, and there was a woman who literally used Python every day for the last like 2-3 years. And after the first day, she came to me and said, really? We're going to be learning this in this course? I said, yeah, that's what's on the syllabus. And she said, oh, really? So she hadn't read the syllabus, so her expectations were wrong. And then she did not show up on the final day, because I'm sure she was convinced, well, it's not going to be more basic stuff, when that was the truly advanced sort of tying together all the threads that I discussed until then. So, like, and then, of course, she gave me a bad review, saying, well, this course was not at all what I wanted. So it was sort of frustrating all around that I had to thread this needle in a difficult way. I thought I was doing sort of the best job possible, and yet, because she came in with her preconceptions as to what I was going to be teaching or should be teaching, it frustrated her, which in the end frustrated me as well.
Yeah, that's too sad. What is your next big thing?
So on the teaching front, data science and machine learning are like the biggest, hugest thing sort of in technology right now. And fortunately, Python, the language I've been teaching and using for a long time, is the number one language in that. So I'm trying to ramp up my knowledge in data science and machine learning so that I can teach that more and more. In parallel, I'm also working on a bunch of different products, for paid products for programmers. I've had a few products for a few years, but now I'm becoming more serious about it and trying to be smarter about it, whether it's teaching courses online, whether it's having a paid subscription service. And we'll sort of see where that goes. A lot of it's at the beginning, but I see much more potential there because I can deal with, as I'm sure you know, lots of individuals rather than big companies.
I imagine selling a little, you know, info products online, it requires a completely different skill set as opposed to making, you know, huge dollars like you are in person with big companies.
Yeah. So that's why it's nice that I have the corporate training. They are my investors in my product business. And luckily they're not the sorts of investors who will pull the plug. I have to be the one to pull the plug if it goes poorly.
I'm sure it's going to be great. Don't worry. So let's talk back about the big companies. So I got first introduced to the topic last year, and your talk at WRA Freelancing Conference in Stockholm just blew my mind and sent me into a tailspin, in a career tailspin with training. I was like, yes, this is amazing. So to our listeners who don't know, could you just briefly describe the life cycle, the lifestyle and what you're actually selling and how much you're getting and who you're dealing with when it comes to enterprise in-person training?
Sure. So, so here's the thing. Most consultants that are dealing with technical companies, and I'm going to assume that for UI people it's similar, even though it's obviously slightly different. You're sort of going in and you're selling them your skills, right? You're selling whether it's like productized or not. At the end of the day, they want a program, they want design. And when you price it for them, they're thinking, what's the ROI on this? And even more than that, they're thinking, well, what would it cost me to have a full-time employee do this? And so part of the pushback you get often from companies is, what? You're going to charge me how much? I could just hire a full-timer for 2 months to do what you're claiming you'll do in 2 days. Maybe yes, maybe no. So training is a whole different kettle of fish because you're dealing with different people, different budgets, different perspective. And these companies basically are saying, how can we make our company more effective, more efficient? How can we do more with fewer people in less time? And or be more effective at it. And so the training manager, and that's my term for whoever's in charge of training, and they rarely have the title training manager. It can be the human resources person, it can be the COO, all sorts of people. They basically are always looking for ways to make their people more effective and more efficient. And one way that they do that is through training. So most companies will have a training budget. And the way I think about it is that the training manager is sort of like an investment manager. They have this pool of money and they are supposed to invest it so that the people will be more effective. And the amounts of money that they have to do that are wildly different than the amounts of money that the development people have to hire staff to help them. So just as like an example, now I don't teach that much in Europe. In fact, there was a bit of a dispute between me and my major client there over how much I was being paid. So I've gone to Europe a lot less in the last few months than I was hoping to. Oh well. But typically in Europe and in the US, they will pay $5,000 to $6,000 per day. Let me just repeat that because it is not a, it's a verbal typo. $5,000 to $6,000 per day for training. And it sounds astonishing. Like a 4-day course, they will indeed pay $20,000 for you to teach. Now, they're expecting good quality, right? They're expecting you to be able to explain it well. They're expecting good interactions. They're expecting that your survey at the end, and it's always there, will come out well. But if it sounds like a god-awful amount of money for you, you have to remember that from their perspective, think about it. Let's say you have 10 engineers in the course, and each engineer is earning $100,000 a year. So that's $1 million per year. If you can make them 5% more effective, you've now improved the company's bottom line by $50,000. So of course they'll pay $20,000 to improve things by $50,000, right? Like that's a no-brainer. And so when you think about things in that way, then they're much like it makes more sense. It also makes sense that they expect that you're going to be part of a training company with overhead. So you'll have a sales department and a marketing department and a bookkeeping department and God knows what else. And when it's an individual or a small number of individuals doing it, that you could basically pocket that, assuming you can get in the door.
Sounds like magic. Absolutely. And so we have a wonderful product market fit. You have knowledge and, more importantly, a recyclable, reusable course that you can teach to multiple companies in person, and they do have a specific budget for it. Isn't that amazing?
It's great. And it also means that if they are happy with you, they will invite you back. I mean, we're recording this in late July 2017. So I just got, I don't want to say an ultimatum, but close to it from two of my clients saying, if you don't give us dates through June of 2018, we will have to go to your competitors because we want to fill those dates. So please give us dates soon.
Oh my goodness.
it's madness because I'm already asking my wife, like, when does she have important stuff for work? In 2018, so that I don't like go abroad when she has things. I'm trying to figure out when conferences are taking place then, because no one's put out their dates for it. So it's a little complicated. At the same time, it's a great feeling. And once you're in with a company, they will just keep coming back to you again and again. And if you think it's like boring to teach the same thing again and again. It's a personality thing. I see it as putting on a one-man play repeatedly, right? So, like, I get on stage and I give, you know, do my show, and the next day I go on stage and I give my show again. And if that's – and obviously there are little tweaks here and there and, like, things you can improve and change. But I know when I'm going to tell certain stories, and I know when I'm going to tell certain jokes. And I even know what errors people are going to make in certain exercises. And so I tweak the exercises to force them to make those errors so that they'll complain. And then I'll be like, okay, don't do that in the future.
That sounds awesome. Can you introduce our listeners to the format? So let's imagine you're in Israel. Your training assignment is in Amsterdam. So you're flying in person and spending there a couple days one, two, three, four, doing an in-person workshop. What's happening there? Who is sitting there? How many people? What are you doing? How much of that is practice and theory?
Excellent, excellent questions. So most companies will pay you like for the course, and different places pay in different ways, whether it's per person or per day. I prefer to charge per day. And then if it's per day, I will set a maximum number of people that I'll accept. And I usually say between 16 and 20. They will set a minimum number of people for the course to open. And that's usually about 8 to 10. So it's like justifies itself. So I'll arrive there like, and usually on top of whatever budget they have for training, they'll also add for traveling expenses. So the way that I describe it is if I'm willing to swim there and pitch a tent on the sidewalk, then I get to pocket all the money. And if I instead want to be a normal person and fly there and get a hotel, I can choose how high star, low star hotel I want to get.
Personal question of the tracks. Do you travel business or economy there?
Oh, economy. I'm a super cheapskate.
Okay. However, that's called sustainable.
Right. I mean, although I'll tell you, I travel to China a few times a year, and in that case, they actually pay for my travel and my hotel. Like, I don't touch that. It's sort of part of the package they deal with. Mm-hmm. And I have basically put my foot down and said, I want to fly on Turkish. So I now have, because of the number of miles I've flown, like elite status on Turkish, which means I get to like go to the lounge. They treat me very well. So I'm not in business class, but it's like, as far as I'm concerned, if I get good legroom, because I'm a little tall, if I get good legroom, like with the emergency exit, which you also get as being an elite member, then I'm more than happy.
Sounds awesome. Oh, thank you for this little side note.
Sure.
Back to the format. So what's happening there?
So typically I'll show up like half an hour, 45 minutes before I'm supposed to teach. I'll tell them I'm supposed to be in such and such a room, and they'll take me to that room. And I always insist, like part of my proposal is I say, I need to have a projector, and I need to have a whiteboard or a flip chart. I need to have internet access. And so I go there and I make sure all those things are there, and I plug my computer in. And really nowadays, plugging into a projector is a no-brainer. Like, it used to be terrible. Nowadays, it just always works, which is great. And I always have a few adapters with me for power and for video for different countries and for different formats. So people will then come in. It's usually between, as I said, like 10 and 20 people. I always try to email them about a day or two in advance saying, here are the expectations, here are my slides in PDF, here's what I want you to install, and please bring a computer. And so I open up the course by introducing myself, and I give them the logistical stuff. Like, we're going to go from this hour to that hour. We're going to take a lunch break in the middle of the day. I usually try to push lunch as late as humanly possible. I joke with them not only because I enjoy starving my students, but because but like the real reason is because after lunch people are less focused. That said, countries have very strong opinions about when to have lunch. And so, like, when in Belgium, I told them, I want to have lunch at 1, they said, the kitchen will be closed then. So we had lunch at 12:30, and that was that. and then I open up, and I used to use my slides a lot more. And nowadays, I basically don't use my slides. I do a lot of live coding and demonstrations. And so I'll open up, in the Python world, it's called the Jupyter Notebook. And I say, here, I'm going to show you this. It's just basically a day of live demonstrations broken up by a lot of exercises. And exercises are key. They are key to you getting the gig, and they are key to people learning, and they're key to you returning. I've learned basically you cannot give too many exercises. They cannot be broken down enough, and people will just eat it up. Every year, I reduce the content of each of my courses, and I increase the number of exercises, and people are happier.
That's quite a magical thing.
Because look, they, I mean, look, I think you know, like one of my hobbies slash obsessions is I'm learning Chinese. And I always tell people it's the best thing I've ever done for my teaching, because I'm so sensitive now to the fact that you learn something, you hear it once, you practice it once, and it's basically worthless. It's only after repeated practice from different directions and different perspectives that you actually begin to internalize something and learn it. And so the more exercises to force them to think in different ways to use the same thing, and the more I can have later exercises come back and reference those earlier ideas, the better for everyone involved. And so typically companies will ask, how much is exercises? And I tell them 30%. And that seems to be a number that satisfies them. And I think it's even close to true.
Mm-hmm. So do people just open up their laptops and do stuff? And what do? Do they peek over their shoulders, or how does it work?
So in my particular case, I tend to expect them to actively call me over. So I'll introduce the topics. Like, I'll talk about something for, say, 20, 30 minutes, and I'll demo it. And I'll say, okay, let's try an exercise having to do with this. And I usually write down, in an editor, what I want them to do. So if I want you to get these inputs and produce these outputs. And then I say, okay, go work on this. I strongly encourage them to work in pairs. People who work in pairs learn way, way, way more and way better, and they are extremely reluctant to do it. So I sort of like, I tell them, I know that you're not going to want to do it. Those of you who do will benefit greatly, and I won't take it personally. And then I say, okay, while you're working on this, let me know if you have problems. In most places, I find that they will call me over if they have problems. China, less so. China, for whatever reason, like they will just keep going on their own. I mean, I had a situation about 2-3 months ago.
What level of success? Yeah.
Oh, right. I had a situation like 2-3 months ago where someone called me over and said, I'm not sure how to deal with this data file you gave me. I look at it, I said, oh my God, I gave it to you in the wrong format. I'm so sorry. Was anyone else having problems with this? And 100% of the hands go up. This was after 15 minutes of them struggling with it. So in most places, they'll call me over if they have problems. And so I spend the exercise time going between people. And if they don't ask me for questions, then I sort of wait on the side or wait at my computer. Every few minutes I'll say, okay, who's done? And when I get like half to two-thirds of the people done, then I say, okay, let's go over together. And solving the exercise in front of them, going over it, I'm convinced is an important thing to do, because it shows them the process. The end result is not the important thing. The process is the important thing. And so seeing how you solve a problem from zero, like from a blank sheet of paper, from a blank the editor, to where something working is important. And at the end of each day, I send them a zip file with everything we did, all my solutions from the day, as well as all the live coding demos that I was doing, so they can review that on their own.
Wonderful. So this is the process. When you put together an agenda, is it just totally your, you know, piece of art, or are you using some existing educational materials to guide your course?
It's usually just my sort of intuition / decisions, and it's a huge amount of evolution. In my data science course, I feel like, I mean, I've taught it now like 15, maybe 20 times. And I used to tell people it takes about 10 to 20 times for a course to be solid. This one is still like not quite where I want to be. I'm still getting feedback from people that it needs to be changed a bit. I'm going to change it from 3 days to 4 days. And there are always going to be revisions. This one just seems to be more, which might mean that my other courses took equally long and were equally complex to change. So I usually start off with, actually, even though I don't use slides that much when I'm presenting, I use Keynote a lot to outline my ideas. I use it as an outliner, basically. And so I'll open up like multiple keynote presentations, one of them for each sort of subtopic I want to address. And with each one of them, I figure if I have only like 5 slides in a topic, then either I need to put that into another topic, like joint with another presentation, or I'm not giving it a reasonable amount of depth. Then I go into more depth. And so I'll end up with, you know, 5, 10, 15 keynote presentations, each of which has between 15 and 60 slides. And then I'm like, well, will this really work? And then I sort of go through it on my own. I say, well, yeah, I guess so. And some of it's based on what I've learned, and some of it's based on where I see people having problems. And always then, like, it's a lot of experimentation. And you just hope that people don't hate you faster than you improve it.
All right. So we discussed what the product is, what that you're selling, what the technical training, you know, what it looks like. Now the hard part, how do you get your foot in the door of selling it to big companies?
This is the hardest question to answer because everyone seems to have their own route. So I'll tell you what I did, and I'll tell you what other people I know have done, and I've also started asking around and checking with companies to get their inputs. And some combination of this will hopefully work for people.
Perfect. So let's go for it.
All right. So first of all, you have to demonstrate expertise. And you have to demonstrate not just expertise. So there are two kinds of knowledge in the teaching biz. There is what's called content knowledge, right? You know your stuff. And then there's what's called pedagogical content knowledge. Do you know how to teach it? Do you know how to explain it? These are two separate skills, right? You, I'm sure, know people who are super experts. Everyone jokes about university professors like this, right? Like the most brilliant people ever who cannot communicate their ideas. And the great teachers don't necessarily know the stuff as well as these great professors. So you want to demonstrate both your deep knowledge and your ability to communicate it. And I think that comes across best speaking at meetups, user groups, conferences. Because then people are like, oh, I saw them teach. They are great. I want to get them to my company. And my experience is virtually every time I speak at a conference, I get a gig out of it teaching or consulting, usually teaching nowadays. It helps to say explicitly, I do training, right? Like say it at the beginning of your talk, say at the end of your talk. It's one of these things where it doesn't come off as a huge personal advertisement. But you want people to know, yeah, you can have me in person at your company do this. And it might take months, but I think people will come up to you.
Can I insert my two cents?
Please.
Just for people to know how you get your foot in the door of the conferences, it doesn't happen magically. You have to pitch your own talks there, especially in the beginning when you're just starting out. And when you do, you have to prove your expertise again. It can be, you know, it can be an easier level of expertise. You can show them your amazing video blog, your amazing regular blog, maybe a self-published book, which is an easy track. So something of that sort, and it starts to snowball slowly.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And you'll find like there's this guy who runs conferences in Israel who basically always calls me and asks me to speak at his conferences. So like he likes me, he trusts me, and everyone can sort of have their, I don't know, pet conference organizer for whom it's a big win for everyone. They don't have to fill a slot because they trust you, and you then get a platform to demonstrate your expertise in front of yet more people.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say like beyond speaking there and beyond, and I think blogging is also very useful. Like, I don't know how many people hire me for my training based on my blog, but I do think, like, I just talked at a company for the first time last week. And the one of the heads of their analysis group said something about how, oh, well, you know, I subscribe to your newsletter. I said, oh, really? I had no idea. Now, I'm convinced, although I have no proof of this, I'm not about to ask him, I'm convinced that when they sort of came across my name, they said, hey, does anyone know who this guy is? And he said, oh yeah, I subscribe to his newsletter, he knows his stuff. So having demonstrated, again, expertise that people out there will hear about, that you'll just become a sort of well-known name in the field is definitely useful and important.
My two cents here again.
Excellent.
A blog serves two purposes. One is the word of mouth that you just described, but it's not going to happen from day one, week one, or year one, most likely. But even if you're just starting out in silence, whenever you just link to your blog, that serves as an instant proof of credibility that you can literally write about your subject well. That's true for the way I vet podcast guests, any other person, maybe conference speakers. When you hire someone, when you see that they have a professional blog, that's an instant qualifier. So it starts to serve you from day one, and then its role even increases again as a marketing tool.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's say like beyond conferences and beyond blogging and so forth, how can you get your foot in the door? And this is the toughest nut to crack. So I used to tell people, well, you should contact the training managers at companies,
mm-hmm.
Because I know that they're always on the lookout for training. The thing is, I spoke to a training manager about this about a month ago, and I asked her, like, how can people reach out to you? And she said, you know, if someone just contacts me, I mean, think of how you feel when someone cold calls you. And they might be a huge expert, but you're going to be really skeptical and it's going to feel kind of slimy. My impression is that's how they feel if someone contacts them like this. However, if one of their managers in the company has heard about you, so this is why, like, if you go to a conference and you speak, and one of the managers at the company calls the training manager and says, hey, I need a course in such and such, and I saw this person. That's great. So you want to sort of use your contacts and like use them. I just got emailed from someone saying, how can I help you with your business a bit for all sorts of complicated reasons. And I said, well, if you could introduce me to people who are looking for training, I'd really appreciate it. I'm waiting to hear back for hope they'll be positive. But you just sort of use your networking contacts. And most people in the high-tech world know people who are at companies where they might be able to use your expertise. And you could just say, hey, are you guys looking for a course in UI, UX? And most people will say no. And some people will say yes. And then you can say, oh, can you put me in touch with, maybe we can have a conference call with your training manager to talk about what your needs are. This training manager also gave me a hint, which I've not acted on, but I thought was brilliant. She said, go to conferences about training. Like their conferences, just like your conferences for everything else, right? And they are on the lookout for, like they're very receptive to people who are offering them training. Like that's where they're open to it. And she said, don't give me just a business card. Don't give me an email address or website. Give me a printed list of the courses you offer with the syllabi. And I will then look over it. And that gives me the greatest chance to sort of think about it, maybe not right away, but over time afterwards. So I thought that was a very interesting sort of answer.
That's great. So you have to find a back door in the company. The cold outreach thing doesn't work. And I tried it. I can testify it does not work.
I tried it also, by the way. I was trying to get more courses in Europe. And like I tried reaching out to some companies. And the best response I got was someone saying no, I think in as many words. and there's a kind of like everyone else was just sort of stone silent. And I think it was Jonathan Stark recommended that I read this book called like Selling to Big Companies. I started reading the book. It's something like three pages in. She said, and don't do, and described precisely the sort of outreach I was doing. So, so it's hard. It's very, very hard.
I can give a real life story because after your speech last year, I was so inspired that I literally booked tickets to London. I booked a hotel for myself and I said, yes, I'm going to go ahead. I only have like 2 months before, 2 weeks before the event. I'm going to go and find myself gigs. And, wow. that was also, I probably was supercharged by another self-development book that said like you should do something like that, take the bull by the horns. But no, it did not work. The way to do is to slowly network your way into that.
It's a slow process. Look, one of the reasons why I have my mailing list is that I'm hoping that over time and I say at the bottom of most messages, are you interested in having me come and train at your company? And all I need, and this hasn't happened yet, I guess, but like, I guess it has if I include the company from last week. Excuse me. But all I need is for one or two companies a year to say, yeah, we would like to have him help out. And so I think the way you described like a backdoor is indeed the best way, which is sad, but that seems to be the state of affairs. That said, they generally pay, and by the way, I should note, in Israel, they pay way less than in Europe and the U.S. So I'm not making we're still struggling here like everyone else, but I'm definitely making, the moment that I moved from teaching for this training company to teaching on my own, my salary literally doubled every day because they were taking a 50% cut. So that definitely better than before. I'll also mention...
Speaking of training companies, that is a backdoor by itself.
Absolutely.
So what were you saying? Maybe you were going to say exactly the same?
Yes. Exactly. So here's the thing. The good news with training companies is they have massive demand. They do marketing. They have their tentacles in all these different companies. They will get you there. The bad news is you get paid less and often much less. And here's the real rub. They will sign you on a non-compete contract. So now one company, like a training company that I work with, I only work with a training company in China. Everywhere else I work directly with companies. And the training company in China basically said, okay, our non-compete is you cannot work with any of our clients for 3 years after you're done with us. And I said, wait, do you mean that I can't work with, like, you may have never introduced me to a client. But like, if you have worked with them, then I can't work with them, even if I didn't even know you worked with them for 3 years. And they said yes, and I said no. And we managed to negotiate to something much less draconian. Most places are not going to be that crazy. Most places will be something like, you can't train for anyone you went to through us for a year. Mm-hmm. And you have to decide. You have to decide, basically, is it worth that trade-off to get yourself known and get sort of some easier cash, and get into the training market, knowing that you're basically blocking yourself from being able to go into those companies later on, at least for a year. It might be worth it. Many people do this, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, especially since, and this is another way to get business, although this is like a long-term thing. What I'm finding now is companies will call me and say, we need a course in Python. And I always ask them, how did you get to me? And the answer is, well, you gave a course at some other company, and their employee came to us. So I'm sort of taking advantage, not actively, but taking advantage of the fact that people in high tech move around. And so if they move around every year or two to do jobs, they will be your recommenders, which is, by the way, another reason, get them on your mailing list, get them on your LinkedIn list, so that when you make updates, they will be like, oh yeah, they do training. Hey, we need training. I should mention them to my boss.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, and again, the snowball effect works, but you've got to be starting somewhere. Either design your own wonderful magical backdoor or go with a training company and dedicate and lose money, I guess.
It's not losing money. Look, they pay okay. Right. Like, you have a very good life and living working for them. But mm-hmm. Here, I'll just give an example. There was one training company that I spoke to in the U.S. where they really wanted to work with me. And they were super nice and decent in every possible way. And when it came to payment, I said, I know how much American companies pay. As I said, it's like $6,000 a day. And they said, well, we can pay you $1,600 per day. I said, thinking to myself, that's how you have the fancy offices, huh? because right. that's a very nice percentage for them to be taking in. And they were unwilling to negotiate over that. So I said no to them.
Because there is always a lot of talent, but selling it is the hard part. So it's quite fair, I should say, selling and marketing it.
Interesting. I don't know. I can see it being like 50%. I can see it being like, but like they were taking like, what would that be? Something like, 65%, something along those lines, which seemed to me a little on the high side. But you're right. You're right. Getting into those companies, establishing those relationships, as we've been saying, takes time and takes effort. I'm not trying to say they have zero. At the same time, once you're in a company, you're in for a long time. And at that point, the fact that they're continuing to get that, 60-whatever% seems a little extreme to me.
But one thing you're definitely gaining is you get to hone your teaching craft, the pedagogical side of thing.
For sure. For sure. And that's crucial. The number of people who get up in front of an audience and say, hello, welcome to Introduction to Whatever, slide one, slide two, right? Like, it's huge. And those, that's like, that's the average out there. And you want to make sure that you really stand out. And it takes practice.
I have a question. Do you have any favorite resources or books where people can learn to be good teachers? With the only exception of practice, of course, but maybe there is something to read up on.
Interesting. Hold on. I'm just going to roll my chair over to take two books off the shelf. there we go. Okay. So I've started to look through these books. I haven't read them completely yet, but they both seem to be like certainly food for thought. So one of them is called, and I'll put these in the show notes as well, Training from the Back of the Room, 65 Ways to Step Aside and Let Them Learn. It's all about professional training. It turns out there's an organization for professional training, which I'm trying to learn more about and find out about because, it would be nice to exchange ideas with other professionals, not necessarily in programming. And the other one is called Telling Ain't Training. And this is so true, right? Like, again, imagine how many lectures you've had in university or elsewhere where they just tell you things and there's no way that you're going to remember them. And getting them to do things and actively do things and talk to each other. One of the techniques in this book is, and I haven't tried this yet because I'm too embarrassed to do it, but every 10 minutes, have people stand up, turn to the person next to them, and explain to them what we just did in class.
Oh, like, wow, isn't that sweet?
That's brilliant, right? It's brilliant because they won't be able to do it. But by having to talk to each other, first of all, it like shakes things up in the classroom. And second of all, it forces them to say, well, what was really the point? How can I summarize this? And summarizing is an important skill.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it might also help to learn like there's this book that we had to read in graduate school called How People Learn. And it was like the latest science on how people learn and what you can sort of what tricks and techniques you can do. And one of the big things is something called metacognition. If you're thinking about learning while you're learning, and if you're thinking like what you've learned, then it can really help. And I'll also mention like something that might not be an obvious resource for people who are doing training. I've only looked at part of it so far, but there's this mastermind company that advertises on Facebook nonstop. And I actually bought their course from Steve Martin on comedy. Now, my family would argue I'm not at all funny. they're happy to have me out of the house, right? But I'm not saying necessarily that all trainers should try to be funny all the time. But the way he describes sort of crafting jokes and crafting like as writing and honing and improving, and that in stand-up comedy, you try it one night, and if the joke does well, you improve it. And if the joke does poorly, you then have to decide, do I keep it or do I dump it? And I'm constantly doing that with my training, right? Did this story really help to pull things together, or was it just a distraction? Did this exercise really help them, or did it bomb? And so, over time, you'll get it. Sorry.
Yes. No, go ahead.
No, that's just over time, you get it. I can talk forever. That's why I'm in this business, right?
So this wonderful charisma and your, you know, charm is not just natural charm, but your honed way of delivering jokes and saying what works and just honing this over and over and over.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And definitely like I see sometimes I change things around to sort of see how it works. And sometimes like I'm always on the lookout for stories, right? Stories that people can identify with that will help, not necessarily even technical stories, right? Just stories that will sort of bring a point home or help to connect to the next topic. And if I find a good story, then I will totally use it. Especially if I get good reactions. And that like keeping people involved and interested and participating and interacting, that's super important. Anything you can do to improve that is good.
Yeah, for me it's like level 10 because just knowing is level 1. Teaching that just with dry technical text is level 2. It's doable, even though it's harder. Level 3 is starting to invent stories and including them there. But joking, oh my god, it's like impossible.
You can. I've seen you talk, Jane. Come on, you're great. The thing is, a lot of people even say to me, because like in Israel, people are pretty blunt, right? So they'll say, why am I going to take this course? What is the benefit when in my particular case, right, Python, I can get an almost unlimited amount of information about Python online. There are courses, there are books, everything you'd want, and much of it is free or really low cost. So your goal in the teaching is generally not going to be what information can you provide. It's what shortcuts, what insights, what help can you give to get people to where you are faster. So telling them where you've made mistakes and telling them, walking them through sort of often when I answer an exercise, when I solve an exercise in front of them, I'll say, oh, but this does not work, right? And they'll see where we got stuck and then we'll sort of backtrack and try it in a way that does work. And what I hope is that they'll come out with some understanding of not only what the dry technical material is, but how to approach it and what to do and even what not to do.
Yeah. So as we're closing up on today's episode, just to sum up, thing number one is to figure out how to teach your skill. Well, number zero is probably to have your skill first.
Number one is
how to teach it. And number two is dealing with the big companies. And that means that they are hard to get into. You got to have some backdoor. They're usually slow to pay from my experience. Anything else I'm missing out on?
And it might just take a while. And I would say in some ways startups, I should have mentioned this earlier, startups are in many ways easier to deal with on this front. They won't provide as much work on a regular basis because they're by their very nature small, and they might not be able to pay as much, but they're a good sort of testing ground also, and they're often open to individuals, right? If you find so if there's a technology or a technique, if you're a UI UX person and you call around to a few startups, they might be receptive to courses. It might be worth talking to them at the very least, because they're smaller. And then you can sort of try it out and move on to the larger companies, as it were.
Right. So one final piece of advice for people who have zero experience in technical training but would like to get started.
Webinars. webinars.
Ah, that's perfect.
Cheap, easy, and you can often get them mentioned. I mean, I know in a lot of programming languages, including like HTML5, you have like the blah, blah, blah weekly newsletter. And so you can often get free webinars mentioned in such newsletters. And then you can have those people sign up for your mailing list and you'll get a following. Maybe they'll invite you to teach. But more importantly, you can practice your talk. And because it's free, right, what are they going to do? Ask for a refund? So I've definitely done webinars that's with most of my new material, and I strongly recommend trying it.
You can both, you can either keep running different webinars to your existing audience or take one topic and go around on a tour offering the free webinar to different other audiences and influencers, right?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That's absolutely true. Yes.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for, well, actually, I'd like to give another, just two pieces of information. Webinars are incredibly hard to do if you try to make them interactive. Because if you tried, and you would just see that people are not reacting in the same way when, as opposed to if they were in the same room with you. They're just staring at their screen, wearing headphones, and just, you know, chatting with their colleague in the side chat or something.
Yeah. So I did a few webinars. I think the last one was maybe about a year ago at this point already. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should do more. But one of my frustrations with webinars was that even when people did participate, there was this like 15-second delay. I think I was using Google Hangouts sometimes between the time they would write something and me seeing it. And that was just maddening. So at some point, I think I would say to people, put your comments and questions in the chat and I will address them, but not right away. And even then, you're right. Like, there wasn't that much interaction, but it was okay.
The different kinds of workshops, you can just go ahead and translate your knowledge, in a one side mode. That's totally fine. And that's how most of webinars are done. But if you try to do a workshop, be prepared for these kind of consequences.
Yes, for sure. Like, doing a workshop, I would say a webinar should be a talk. Like, think of it as a conference talk at your own private little one person conference. Right. And you just sort of open it up and you'll get feedback. But even more than getting feedback, because people might be embarrassed to say what they thought, you will have this inner feeling of, okay, X and Y worked really well, and Z, oh, that was terrible. I've got to redo that. And that's good, right? You got, without that sort of constant self-criticism, you're not going to improve.
That's right. Okay, Reuven, where can people find you online? You have multiple awesome things. Tell us about them.
Thank you. Sure. So I've got my company website, which is probably going to be undergoing some changes in the next few weeks and months to be more sort of product oriented. Although immediately after I made that decision, a company called me and said, so we saw on your website new courses. So I might not be changing it as fast as I thought. So that's at learner.co.il. That's learner.co.il. My blog, for the time being at least, although I might be folding into the site, is at blog.learner.co.il. And there are links back and forth between the two of those. Mm-hmm. So that's where like I tend to have information about my courses and where I publish stuff about typically about programming. On my main corporate site, I also have links to my newsletter, my programming newsletter, which is probably not so exciting for people on your list, but they're welcome to join, which I call Better Developers. It comes out every Monday. I also have a newsletter, free newsletter, which I think people might be interested in, called Trainer Weekly. And you can get there either through my website or at, that's right, trainerweekly.com.
Beautiful.
And that also comes out every Monday. And that's just like short insights about the business side, the pedagogical side, the logistical side of doing training. Everything from do you have lunch with the client to what do you bring in your bag to how do you try to break into companies to exercises you can do. And I've got a few products as well for people who are interested in programming. I mean, I'll mention one or two, although my guess is, again, this is not exactly for your audience. So I have this thing called Weekly Python Exercise that I just launched about a month or two ago, which is a subscription service where every Tuesday you get a programming exercise in Python. And every Friday you get it, the solution sent to you.
Mm. That's interesting.
Well, I'll tell you, it's because I surveyed my mailing list and some
huge number of people said, yes, listening to this episode, we would love to have exercise on a regular basis. Please leave a review on iTunes.
So I went ahead and tried it. It will help other people discover this podcast. So I've got about 50 subscribers now. You know, I'll get to 5 million within a year, give or take a few million. Yes, that's for, I'll just mention it because it's so much fun to talk about. So I also do a newsletter because I don't write enough, called Mandarin Weekly, and it's at mandarinweekly.com. And
I was waiting for it. Yeah. Ian, tell us about it.
And so that is, so basically I was inspired by Peter Cooper, who does all these, programming newsletters once a week. Like he does JavaScript Weekly and HTML5 Weekly and so forth. So, I decided to do something like that for people who are learning Chinese. So Mandarin Weekly is a roundup of about 20 links from the most recent week for people learning Chinese. And within like the next week or two of us talking, I'm just about to launch it, hopefully within the next few days, but I've had some server problems, but I'll be launching the paid version of that, which will let you filter out by level and subject. And that's using Drip Magic, which I am completely blown away by.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Ruben, for sharing your wisdom. I'm sure after today's episode, people just will have an idea how to get into this wonderful, magical world of big money and big companies.
I hope so. I really do. And if any listener has questions about this or wants to contact me, please don't hesitate. Please feel free to email me. I'm sometimes a little bad about getting back to people on time, but I really do love to help people with training stuff, and it would be my pleasure to answer questions.
Thank you so much, Ruben, and have a great day.
You too, Jade.
This episode is brought to you by FreshBooks Cloud Accounting Software. They're offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial to our listeners. Just go to freshbooks.com/UIbreakfast and enter UIbreakfast in the How Did You Hear About Us section. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.